readers will have their first chance next week to see the memoir of a Supreme Court justice's wife. Malvina Harlan's memoirs cover her journey with her husband, Kentucky-born Justice John Marshall Harlan, through the Civil War, his appointment to the Supreme Court, and his role in the racial history of the country. The book also is an account of the everyday life of a Supreme Court wife at the turn of the last century. Ironically, it was a very modern woman, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who brought the memoir out of obscurity and convinced Random House to publish it. Today, part two of NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg's interview with Justice Ginsburg.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg made her mark on American legal history as a pioneer for women's rights. But Malvina Harlan was a woman of her time. Her job was to help her husband, and in those days, that included some huge unofficial duties.
The wives of the justices were expected to open their homes every Monday afternoon to callers, and they were expected to lay a table with salads and rich cakes and to have music and even dancing. And then the justice would come out sometime and make a grand entrance.
How many people would show up at these things?
Malvina wrote that 200, even 300, could show up at an at-home. And these continued into the 1930s.
Today, Supreme Court spouses, including two husbands, have no such duties, though the spouses do get together several times a year for lunches they cook themselves. And the number one cook in demand is Justice Ginsburg's husband, Martin D. Ginsburg, one of the nation's premier tax lawyers and a professor at Georgetown Law School. Marty Ginsburg learned to cook when the couple was first married, stationed at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and received as a gift a copy of the giant Escoffier cookbook.
And he started literally on page one, making all the basic stocks. And in the course of our time at Fort Sill, he had gone through most of the book.
In the beginning, as Justice Ginsburg puts it,
our arrangement was that he would be the weekend and the company cook, and I would be the everyday cook. That continued for a number of years until my daughter was in high school, and she began noticing the difference between daddy's cooking and mommy's cooking, and decided that mommy should be phased out of the kitchen entirely. So for me, it was like Tom Sawyer and the fence. I cooperated in this effort totally. And in all the years that we've been living in D.C., now it's 22 years, I have yet to cook a meal.
Malvina Harlan, upon getting married at age 17, got some rather typical advice for its time from her mother. Remember now that his home is your home, his people your people, his interests your interests. You must have no other. The advice Ruth Bader Ginsburg got at age 17 from her mother was different.
My mother told me to be a lady, and for her that meant be your own person, be independent. She never envisioned a legal career for me, but she did think that it was very important that I be able to support myself, and I think she would be pleased to see what has become of me.
What became of her was that she graduated first in her class from law school and became a law professor and director of the ACLU Women's Rights Project. In 1971, the Supreme Court adopted the argument made in her brief that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution covers women in addition to African Americans.
The words of the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, nor shall any state deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. Well, that word, any person, covers women as well as men. And the Supreme Court woke up to that reality in 1971.
Until then, Ginsburg observes, the law and the court did not view women as equals.
They were weaker, they were dependent prone, they needed a big brother to lean on. And so the Supreme Court had upheld paternalistic laws that said women couldn't practice law, women couldn't be bartenders. All those laws treated women differently, ostensibly for their own benefit, so that they could attend to home and family life. It took a change in society to move the court in another direction.
Today, you're the second woman to serve on this court, of course, along with Justice O'Connor. And I'm wondering, how do you think the presence of women makes a difference on this court, or does it make a difference?
Yes, it makes a difference, but not in where the opinions come out, for the most part.
And yet, said Justice Ginsburg, women bring to the table their own experiences, which inform their decision-making. As an example, she cited a decision written in 1982 by Justice O'Connor, a 5-4 decision in which O'Connor said that the all-female University of Mississippi Nursing School must admit a male applicant.
Justice Powell wrote a dissenting opinion in which he kind of explained the exclusion of men as a permissible preference for women, as a kind of affirmative action program for women. Justice O'Connor said in between the lines, I know what kind of affirmative action this is. Why do you think wages are so low in the nursing profession? Because there are no men in it. She, from her life's experience, knew the best way to upgrade the pay in what was a woman's job was to get men to do it too.
By 1996, the question facing the court was whether the publicly funded Virginia Military Institute could exclude women. And this time, it was Ginsburg writing the court's opinion.
And that decision, 5-4 in 1982, then becomes 7-1 in 1996 in the VMI case, because the two cases were essentially the same. In one, men were barred, and the other, women were barred, but the principle at work was the same. So the court had learned a lot in those years between 82 and 96.
One subject, though, that the court continues to struggle with is capital punishment and how to apply it.
I'm wondering whether those cases take a toll on you at all, or whether they just sort of go with the territory.
They take a terrible toll, and I expect they always will. The first time I was part of this process, it was a bloody murder. It was just a horrendous crime. But I stayed up past the hour that the execution occurred, and I cried, and then I was over it, and it was the next day. I don't cry anymore, but I still, every time I'm part of that process, I am unsettled by it.
And do you think all of your colleagues react that way?
Probably some are satisfied that it's the will of the people. The people want a death penalty, they'll have it. If they don't want it, they won't have it. It isn't our job to make that decision.
I have to ask you before we close, you have been very generous in not keeping secret the fact that you had colon cancer about a year and a half ago. So I have to ask you, how is your health?
Very good. I've come a long way since the end of the colon cancer surgery, then chemotherapy, then radiation, and by the time I got through with all of that, I was not in very good shape. I had lost a tremendous amount of weight, but with a good cook and lots of sympathy and understanding from my colleagues and a personal trainer twice a week, I got back in shape.
So you're not planning to retire anytime soon?
As long as I can do this good job, I will.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The Malvina Harlan memoir she brought out of obscurity will be in the bookstores next week. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.